Good afternoon, it's Mountain Edition. I'm Allison Bechtesh.
And I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. Aspen had its busiest and priciest holiday season on record.
And weeks of snow have Aspen's street crews working hard.
The contenders are in for Carbondale's open trustee seat.
And a new program will mince mattresses in the name of the environment.
Those stories and more coming up on Mountain Edition.
The results are in from an environmental analysis of the proposed expansion of the Aspen-Pitkin County Airport. The public has a chance to learn more tonight.
The most recent environmental assessment looked at noise, air quality, and climate, among other areas of concern. So far, officials say there are no major red flags that would derail the project, which includes relocating the runway. Because of that change, there would need to be mitigation work on the wetlands along Owl Creek Road. The public can review the environmental impacts, ask questions, and provide feedback today from 4:30 to 6:30 at the Gantt.
It seems business was up in just about every sector during the week between Christmas and New Year's, based on reports from the Aspen Skiing Company and the resort community. As Carolyn Zachariasen reports, huge records were posted in the lodging sector as well.
The average room rate in Aspen during December was $775 a night. That represents a whopping 27% increase over the same period last year, when it was only $609 to stay in a room here. But the high dollar rate didn't deter visitors. December finished with a holiday stretch as strong as it ever was, with five straight days of 95% or more occupancy. That's according to the latest report released by Central Reservations Agency Stay Aspen Snowmass. As far as this month goes, Aspen and Snowmass are pacing ahead of last year, and with Winter X Games next week, bookings are expected to increase. Carolyn Zachariasen, Aspen Public Radio News.
One of the first contenders for the 2018 gubernatorial race in Colorado has announced his candidacy. Correspondent Benta Berkland has more.
Michael Johnston served almost two full terms as a Democratic state senator representing Denver. He's also a former teacher, high school principal, and education advisor to President Obama. With current Governor John Hickenlooper term limited, Johnston says it made sense to start campaigning early.
There's just such a groundswell of momentum right now of people who want to be involved in politics and want to build a different kind of future for the state, want to be able to prove that we can still solve big problems in the public square.
Johnston was the architect behind the state's teacher evaluation system, which eliminated tenure. He says he wants to protect access to health care, college, and clean air. Prominent Democrats, such as former U.S. Senator Ken Salazar and U.S. Representative Ed Perlmutter, are also rumored to be considering gubernatorial bids. I'm Benta Berkland at the state capitol.
Applications are in for Carbondale's Board of Trustees seat. Current trustees opted for an application process over an election. Aspen Public Radio's Wyatt Orm has the details.
The deadline was Friday, January 13th at 5 p.m. The town received eight applications: Jim Bredstead, April Spaulding, Rebecca Mahler, Doc Phillip, Erica Sparhawk, Michael Durant, Sarah Johnson, and Beth Broom. They submitted short, written statements about why they were applying and what their skills are. All were asked to include 25 signatures from community members in support of their candidacy. The current Board of Trustees will interview the applicants at the upcoming trustee meeting on the 24th. The seat was left vacant when Dan Richardson, formerly a trustee, was elected mayor in November. Once selected, the trustee's term will expire in April of 2018. Wyatt Orm, Aspen Public Radio News.
Aspen's community development team was granted more time to make changes to the city's land use codes during a city council work session on Tuesday. When a development moratorium was enacted last March, the freeze on land use applications was set to expire on February 28th of this year. But in a letter to council written late last week, City Attorney Jim True says more time is needed. By law, there is a 30-day delay between an ordinance being approved and going into effect, which means currently there would be a slight gap between the moratorium being over and developers being required to abide by the new code. Tuesday's meeting was the first reading of an ordinance that would extend the moratorium until March 17th.
Mike Kozdrowski has been at the helm of the Aspen-Pitkin County Housing Authority for 2 years. In that time, he's realized that an overhaul of a system, which encompasses nearly 3,000 units, is long overdue. Aspen Public Radio's Carolyn Zachariasen caught up with Kozdrowski in the Silver Queen gondola to reflect on where the program is headed.
So obviously there's a lot of energy going into the management of existing inventory. I know that you realize that there's how great the need is out there. How much do you see APSHA building or developing or, in unison with the city in the next few years?
We support the city's efforts to develop, for example, the three land-bank parcels in the community and make those rentals for, more lower category working households.
Is there a conversation internally, though, about, should we try to start thinking about BMC West? More Burlingame, or
that's down the line. Those conversations are not immediate, really, from my point of view, since APSHA is not technically in the development business any longer. I hear the loud and clear the calls for using our inventory more efficiently. And if we can do that, we can save the taxpayers a lot of money down the road by not having to build more units necessarily. If we can allow the market, the deed-restricted market, to operate more effectively and efficiently, that's going to make an incredible difference, I think.
Are you talking about buy-downs and the retirees that are in there and trying to get them to move down into smaller units?
I look at the reforming of the APSHA and the system and the program as kind of a three-legged stool. First is information, and then the second leg is creating flexibility within the system. And that information and that flexibility will allow the market participants to create more mobility, allowing people to either move up in the system should they need to when they have another child or so, or to be able to move down as life circumstances change and, their kids have moved on and, they don't need as much space, but yet they want to stay in Aspen. So I think it's information, it's creating more flexibility within the system and the rules, and then in turn, those two things will create that third leg of the stool, which is mobility, which will really increase the efficiency of using the current inventory.
That was Mike Kostrowski, director of the Upper Valley's Affordable Housing Program, speaking with news director Carolyn Zachariasen. To hear more of the conversation, go to aspenpublicradio.org.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. To stay up to date with news in the Roaring Fork Valley, follow us on social media. Like us on Facebook, find Aspen Pub Radio on Twitter, or follow us on Instagram. Aspen Public Radio, your news, your music, your station.
Administrators at Aspen Schools recently finished a thorough round of testing, but these tests are not for students. Elizabeth spent an afternoon checking out the school's energy systems.
Upgrading a school building is not always an easy task. Don Stalker is in charge of maintenance at Aspen High School, and he has a long list of things that need attention.
The heating is an issue. Our controls are not tied in completely yet. Most of the lighting has been switched out in here. I haven't been into the plumbing far enough to see if the low flow and all that has been taken care of.
Stalker has been through this. Before the high school, he took care of the elementary school. That building dates back to 1992, and Stalker made big improvements, including saving gallons and gallons of water.
You have to take the toilet apart to see how much water it uses based off of what size valve's in it and change the valve.
How long did that take? Looking at every toilet.
It's taken me 2 years to get that far. It's when I have time. You can't affect the kids, so it's either when I'm working late, I come in at 6 o'clock in the morning to get 2 hours before anybody gets here to get that type of stuff done.
How many toilets at the elementary school?
78. And all the sinks, there's 90-some sinks. I've replaced almost 3/4 of them.
Those low-flow toilets save 3 gallons every flush, hundreds of gallons every day. But administrators have found quicker fixes for some of the school's other problems. About 3 years ago, the Community Office for Resource Efficiency, or CORE, hooked the Aspen School District up with a $30,000 grant to identify inefficiencies in the buildings. There were several easy updates, says Assistant Superintendent Tom Heald.
The low-hanging fruit was upgrading all the lighting fixtures and the lighting process that we used here in the high school.
And CORE found another grant, this time $125,000 from Holy Cross Energy. Now Stalker explains, when students head to rooms like the gym,
you can walk in the door and the light above you is the only one that comes on.
Those low-hanging upgrades have saved the school about $54,000 a year for the past 2 years. Or as Heald puts it,
that's essentially a teaching salary.
85% of the school system's budget is for salaries and personnel costs. The schools have also saved 500,000 kilowatt hours in electricity for the last 2 years. Marty Treadway with CORE says the average home in Colorado uses about 7,400 kilowatt hours per year. So that savings is enough to power 68 homes for an entire year.
We actually improved the lighting in those spaces. So it's not like the school district is making a sacrifice.
The schools have spent the money provided by those grants, but Heald says the work isn't over.
We want to model ways of thinking and ways of acting which reduce our carbon footprint.
And so administrators are aiming for smarter school buildings, ones that use automated systems more efficiently. Right now, for example, Stalker and his crews can't shut off the heat on Sundays or holidays when no one is in the buildings. District administrators are starting to eye flashier projects. Tom Heald says he's looking into installing solar collectors around campus. Marty Treadway with CORE says this may be a few years down the road.
You know, for us, solar is the icing on a cake that you've already baked. And so we're still baking those cakes at the school district.
Those smaller changes are coming along at the schools, maintenance manager Don Stalker says.
You'd start at that corner of the building, you do 20 feet. And next month, you do another 20 feet and just keep piecing it together.
This approach could be the ticket to meaningful change. Treadway says all of the work done at the schools is replicable in buildings everywhere for a relatively low cost, and it adds up.
40% of all energy consumed in the United States is in our buildings. And so it's ahead of transportation, it's ahead of industry. And so making a difference at home and at work is the most profound way we can engage in energy efficiency.
And at the high school, at least, that could mean one person changing one toilet valve at a time.
As part of ongoing efforts to extend the life of the Pitkin County landfill, the county has announced plans to begin recycling mattresses.
The springs in mattresses bounce right back, even after being run over by the Solid Waste Center's 94,000-pound compactor. So they take up a lot of space and can damage equipment. Now, after a $25 fee, your old mattress can instead be recycled and repurposed by a company called Spring Back Colorado, which will pick up at the landfill. The foam and cotton is then used for things like carpet padding and pet beds. The steel springs are melted and repurposed.
John Marsluff is a professor of wildlife science at the University of Washington. He's in the Valley this week to talk about his research on birds' responses to urbanization. It's part of a local environmental speaker series. Last week, he spoke with Elizabeth by phone from Washington State.
What types of birds tend to do really well in more urbanized environments or suburban environments?
The birds that do well around us are ones that are pretty general in their habits. So think about robins that can nest right along our buildings and forage in our lawns. You also have some of the various sparrows and juncos, the snowbirds, for example. They utilize our feeders readily, and they nest in the smaller shrubs around our houses.
Much of your work deals with crows and ravens, and we have quite a few of those in our area. What can you tell us about their habitat and their habits?
Yeah, crows and ravens are classic adapters to human activity. They really take advantage of everything we do on the landscape because we tend to be pretty sloppy. We provide a lot of food at our refuse dumps or even around our picnic areas. Crows and ravens have increased dramatically in the western U.S. over the last 4 or 5 decades, and there are concerns about that increase. They still have a connotation of death, and people are kind of freaked out when there's a thousand crows coming to roost close to where you live. And they can be challenging from their noise and their droppings. Others are concerned about them from a conservation standpoint. They are predators. They eat young sage grouse and other birds. Understanding that predators are part of the issue is important, but simply getting rid of them is not the real solution. We need to change the way we live on the land.
Your lecture will also consider how settled lands will help play a key role in keeping species alive in the face of climate change. What are some of the things that you're seeing in terms of how birds respond to changing climate?
Well, one of the first things that birds do in response to climate change is shift their phenology of when they migrate and how they migrate and if they migrate. And I'm looking right now, literally about 3 feet from my face is a female Anna's hummingbird sitting on a hummingbird feeder, and it's 25 or 26 degrees outside. That bird did not live here 20 years ago, but with climate change and with planting and putting out feeders, these birds have moved north. And that's the kind of thing we see with lots of other birds, shifts in their range north or south, depending on how the climate has favored them in different places. And birds are lucky in that respect, in that they're very mobile and they're able to track those changing resources.
That was bird expert John Marsleff, who will speak tonight at 7 p.m. at Hallam Lake in Aspen.
In an effort to save Aspen's unique character, a group of locals is proposing restrictions on chain stores in the downtown core. Ahead of today's community forum on that issue, Allison took a stroll around town, surveying the retail offerings and exploring where that unique character really lies.
The offerings along Aspen's shopping strips aren't exactly what you would find on the weekend chore list.
Passing Dior, then Gucci, Pearl Aircraft Corporation, Merrill Lynch Wealth Management.
A new Tesla showroom on the Cooper Avenue Mall comes to mind. And longtime local leaders think this is a problem. I went and talked with one of them, former Mayor Bill Sterling. The walk to his office on East Main Street consists of a lot of what Aspen used to be.
Walking towards Main Street Bakery, which is no longer open. Passing Explorer Booksellers, next to what is self-proclaimed Aspen's most unique retail experience, the Aspen Emporium and Flying Circus.
Last spring, City Council passed an emergency ordinance freezing all downtown development while it overhauls the land use code to fit with community values. As part of that, Sterling, his mayoral successor, John Bennett, and local businessman Jerry Murdoch presented Aspen City Council with the idea for an ordinance that would make it harder for chain stores to move into the downtown. Here's Sterling.
The question of the character of the downtown came up, whether there was a threat to our sort of small town flavor, and the threat that we might become so homogenous as to be unrecognizable as a unique brand.
The proposal is that from now on, if a chain store, defined as having 11 or more retail locations, wants to set up shop in Aspen, it would first need approval from City Council. Similar conditional use ordinances exist in other resort towns, but detractors warn of unforeseen consequences.
I think the town and the residents really need to think about what they're doing with the chain store regulation, because it could have some serious consequences, and I'm not sure it's exactly what those are the consequences we're looking for.
That's Lex Terumians in his office, down from the gondola, across from the recently closed Boogie's Diner. Terumians is the president of Pyramid Properties. His clients are prominent landlords in downtown Aspen. He says the ordinance could potentially crowd out the very vitality it's claiming to preserve. Lugano Diamonds, now within the Little Nell Hotel, is not a chain, but adding it to the Hyman Avenue walking mall wouldn't be a draw for locals. Those stores with salespeople standing in the doorway, thrusting moisturizer samples at passersby, also not chains. But are they really the Aspen character that we're talking about? The hum of Peach's Cafe is a mix of coffee orders and hellos as friends run into each other by the cream and sugar. Sterling says the retail offerings in town are becoming so inaccessible to locals that we've turned online for our sundries, which means a loss of Aspen's small town way of life.
So you go to the places that are community oriented, like the Sun Deck, like the Jerome Bar, like the post office, like Explore Booksellers. You invariably run into someone you know. And instead of calling them up or emailing them, you say, hey, let's ski tomorrow. Those are the things that make a community rich.
True, but is that a chain store issue? Locals joke that they can't go to City Market if they're short on time. It's a guarantee you're going to see someone that you know. City Market, the social hub of Aspen, the literal ground zero for grassroots petitions, is owned by the national Kroger chain. So it seems like in this case, the term chain stores is actually a euphemism for high-end luxury retail stores. Terumian says calling out these types of stores specifically is an oversimplification of the issue. After all, he says, a rising tide lifts all boats, and we all benefit from the cultivation of high-end tastes in town.
All of this is essentially subsidized because we are able to serve high-level, high-paying guests that comes to town.
Local leaders will come together this week to try and draft a mutually acceptable chain store policy. The results of the discussion will be presented to City Council later this winter.
You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. If you missed the first part of today's show, you can find a podcast on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Tune in tonight at 7 on the eve of the inauguration for a special broadcast of Truth, Politics, and Power with Neil Conan, featuring extended conversations with two distinguished scholars, Volker Ulrich, author of the new biography, Hitler, Ascent 1889 to 1939, and historian Robert Kagan, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. That's tonight at 7 here on Aspen Public Radio.
Wet storms this month brought fresh powder up high, but left Aspen's streets flooded and then frozen.
Jerry Nye is Aspen's street superintendent. He says the pipes beneath the storm drains freeze in the winter, so when it rained all day Monday,
so the water's not going anywhere in the stormwater system.
That meant ankle-deep puddles across town, which then froze. Nye and his team plow when it snows 3 inches or more, but major storm events call for bigger clearing. So on Tuesday,
when it turned cold and it snowed like it did, we had to come in and cut all the snowpack off and the ice.
The problem, Nye says, is that there's so much traffic during the days that it's difficult to remove snow from the downtown core. There have been 3 nights so far this month that over 20 cars have been towed to allow crews to clear piles of snow. Starting around midnight, they use a big snowblower to load up dump trucks. On a night of moderate to heavy snow, Nye says his 11-person crews transport about 240 loads of snow to the storage facility at the Airport Business Center. Nye's crews are still working on clearing some giant alley piles in residential areas. The snow storage facility is not big enough to hold it all, but they aim to have streets wide enough for 2 cars to pass. After last week's storms, the storage area was about 3/4 full. If and when it fills up, the excess from future storms will go to Marolt Open Space.
The days between Christmas and New Year's were the busiest in Aspen Skiing Company's history. Carolyn Zachariasen spoke with Ski Co. President and CEO Mike Kaplan about the numbers and the carrying capacity of town.
Aspen Mountain was running pretty steady, around 4,000 through the holidays. And yeah, Island's over 3,000, and Buttermilk close to 3,000, and then Snowmass peaked over 11,000. The peak time seems to get busier. So the 29th was the busiest day we've ever had, at least in terms of in modern history, right? Gates, accurate scanning and all that. The 30th was the third busiest day. So the next day was right up there as well. And then we had a couple other days which were top seven.
Of that time period compared to recent other years?
Yeah, ever in our history, right? So we did, the 28th was like sixth and the 31st was seventh.
How many skier visits in one day?
Totally, it's over 20,000.
Having talked to a lot of longtime business owners, many people who have been doing this for decades said this is the busiest they've ever seen it. They had record sales. They were just jamming. So
for those 4 days, right?
Yes, it was game on. And it's right. Like some people have, they've got some post-traumatic distress disorder.
Right.
How do you address when people argue about carrying capacity? Like, it's too much. We can't handle it.
You know, I would say if you look back at the week before or the week after, especially the week before, it was down from prior year. And so I would say during those peak times, we don't need more people here between December 26th and January 1st. But we could definitely benefit from having more people here before and after. And that's, I think that's the interesting question before the town. How do we have a sustainable level of business and not be overly reliant on a very few periods of time during the year and a relatively small customer base? You know, as we've been looking at the political environment and the good work of the council, say, okay, let's have a moratorium and let's reset. And I think a number of agencies are doing that, right? RAFT is doing that as well. What is the right level of infrastructure? What is the right level of growth? And how do we balance that with our long-term viability and health of the community? You know, there's no silver bullet answer to that.
That was Ski Co. CEO and President Mike Kaplan speaking with News Director Carolyn Zachariasen. To hear more of the conversation, which includes Kaplan's thoughts on the local political climate, the environment, and the resort economy, go to aspenpublicradio.org.
Adam McEwen is a British artist who lives in New York. His work is currently on display at the Aspen Art Museum. Visitors will take an unexpected look at everyday objects like text messages and yoga mats. What they might not realize is that they're not just looking at McEwen's work, but that of many others as well. Aspen Public Radio's Wyatt Orm takes a look at the art of the art exhibit.
If Macaulay Culkin died, his obituary might sound like this.
Macaulay Culkin, star of Home Alone, who survived the perils of childhood.
When you enter Adam McEwen's exhibit at the Aspen Art Museum, you first see the obituaries. They're blown up big and spaced evenly across two parallel walls. Macaulay Culkin isn't dead, of course. Neither is Bill Clinton, whose obituary is also up there. Same goes for Kate Moss. When he was younger, McEwen wrote obituaries for a newspaper in London. Turning them into art is now a signature of his. This is one reason why the audience sees them first. Another reason?
Text-based work makes people feel comfortable.
Heidi Zuckerman curated McEwen's show. She's the director of the Aspen Art Museum.
By making people let down their guard, then you can actually have that much more of an impact. And that's also the creative part of exhibition making.
As curator, she decides what goes into the exhibit and why. To do so, she examined McEwen's entire body of work.
And that's when I came upon this idea of death in the work. And I asked Adam if that would be an okay organizing principle for the show.
Zuckerman says her job is to advocate for artists and help them communicate in ways perhaps they've never thought of before.
I often say that I'm an interpreter.
To do a good job interpreting, she might have to have lengthy discussions with the artists, sometimes over the course of several months. She enjoys this most about her work.
That kind of intellectual sparring, the dialogue, the pushing, the pulling, the, you know, understanding, the revelation, like that's the best part.
But it's not always so seamless. She's butted heads with artists in the past. She also admits she once designed what she now considers a bad show. To curate, though, she must collaborate, and not just with the artist. Someone needs to get the art here, and someone needs to get it up in the galleries. Enter Jonathan Hagman.
I'm the installation director at the Aspen Art Museum. A lot of the exhibition design lands on me, like, where is this wall going to go? How's that going to look? How's the space going to flow?
Hagman's tools include drills, saws, vacuums, tape measurers, and a tiny model of the gallery with magnetic walls. He prints out little images of the works in the show and sticks magnets on the back. This way, he and the curator can talk about what will go where before the artwork arrives. When the artwork does arrive,
we let it sit, climatize before we open any crates or packages.
Like McEwen, an artist with a solo exhibition usually comes to Aspen for the installation. Perfectionism would not begin to describe how the installation team, the artist, and the curator get ready for the exhibit's opening.
2 inches here, an inch there, you know, which ones we pair together, which ones need to be separate.
Hagman says McEwen's show has been straightforward to arrange. They're not all straightforward. He once installed an exhibition by the Brazilian artist Ernesto Neto. It involved a wooden structure, pieces of fabric, audience members lying on benches.
And these bags of crystals would come down and hit your chakra points, and you just lay there. That was a very interactive exhibition.
McEwen's exhibit isn't quite so interactive, but there are lots of pieces on display, more than 50. They even had to leave one out. As Heidi Zuckerman points out, it is simply someone's job to get the art here and get it up. This might sound thankless, so it's important to her that her team spend time in the galleries and absorb the product of their effort.
Let's remember what we're doing is we're exhibition making, we're experience making.
And there's more to it than just what meets the eye. Wyatt Orm, Aspen Public Radio News.
That's all for this week's Mountain Edition. I'm Allison Bektesh.
And I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. To hear this show again or subscribe to our Mountain Edition podcast, head to our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Tune in tomorrow at 3:30 for Valley Roundup. A panel of local journalists joins news director Carolyn Zachariasen for commentary and analysis on the week's news.
Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.